just a little bit after 6:01 p.m. here on WEFT. Sorry, having a little technical issues there. It is just a little after 6 p.m. Here on WEFT. You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Of course, as always, you can always stream us online at weft.org. This is the program where I, and I'll just stay here let me just say this is the program where we're at. My name is Ben. Yes, I'm live in the studio. Sorry for taking the last couple of weeks off. I'm back here live in the studio. I'm going to just play some, before I forget, some public service announcements, pre-recorded service announcements that we have here. So that's what you're about to hear for the next minute or so. So
this hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and the Champaign Park District. Looking for something fun to do this weekend? The Champaign Park District's Weekend Explorer email comes out every Thursday, jam-packed with ideas, events, and programs for each upcoming weekend. Information on subscribing to the Weekend Explorer can be found at champaignparks.org.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible in part by Bash Pepper Roofing. Large or small, they cover them all, commercial or residential. Bash Pepper Roofing offers roofing and re-roofing, gutters, siding, and door needs. For more information, 217-352-2200 or online at bashpepper.com.
Just to let you know that here on where we're at, that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prayer Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And as always, just let you know, there is a new way to listen to WEFT. There is the WEFT app. You can listen to live radio and podcasts from WEFT. You can view playlists, listen to archived programs, and much more. You can listen to the WFT live audio stream. You can view on air and up next programming, connect to WFT community partners, and more via the listen live channel. And I believe you can also leave feedback. WFT app is available on iOS, Apple download, and Android. The Google Play Store and the Apple Store. And as always, there's the Rose Bowl in Urbana. We kind of always like to talk about what's going on over there. It's usually a lot of music, you know, since we play a lot of music. We like a lot of places that play music. So there's the Rose Bowl, www.rosebowltavern.com, where you can check out the calendar. I believe, usually one day, trivia night is Wednesdays, unless if I'm mistaken. And then there's a lot of bands, jazz, all bluegrass, all that type of music. So hope to see you there. There's also, if this is still, the Blues Fest at Prairie Crossroads, the 7th annual Blues Fest. That will be Friday, August 8th, and then Saturday, August 9th. I believe that's at Bunny's Tavern, downtown Urbana, 119 West Weber Street. This says that it is free, so check out some free music if this is true. that's what this is here. So hopefully that is the case. It has been a pretty hot. The heat index, I believe, was over 100. So let's do a quick check of the weather, since I have there's been a heat advisory that remains in effect until 8 p.m. this evening, and then I believe tomorrow it's going to be, you know, another hot day probably tomorrow in the starting, you know, in the afternoon. So if you're able to stay inside or stay somewhere where it's cool or have a lot ice cold water nearby and stay hydrated, you know, that would be, because it's going to get up into the 90s tomorrow Tuesday, 2 p.m. It's going to be a very high heat index, so do be aware of that. Try to take care of yourself and stay cool, stay hydrated. But yeah, tomorrow's going to be an even hotter one than today was. It's summer. And speaking of it being summer, there is the summer cooling program that is available at the Champaign Regional Planning Commission. I still believe that program is available. If you go to community services and then what is that, programs, if you go to ccrpc.org and then under community services, which I think that's, yeah, division, if you go to their website and you just move the mouse cursor on divisions, there's a number of programs, but one of them is the summer cooling program, which is a program that offers basically kind of, I guess you would say, an air conditioning, it's the Regional Planning Commission provides power bill assistance to Champaign County households at most risk from extreme summer heat, such as we've been experiencing. It has all the eligibility criteria. You must be a Champaign County resident. Your household's power services is disconnected or in an imminent disconnect status. Your household's most recent 30-day income must be at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. All that, those details and information, and again, is at ccrpc.org. Go to divisions and then community services and then summer cooling program on their website. It's a very helpful resource and a lot of helpful information and programs for those who are in need. Again, at the Champaign Regional Planning Commission. Grateful for all the work and services that they do. Again, last time, ccrpc.org is their website. They have normal business hours. I'll just say their phone number if you prefer doing it that way. Their phone number or contact information is 217-328-3313. Again, Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, ccrpc.org, their phone number 217-328-3313. I'm going to play. I want to make sure I got my pre-recorded program that I wanted to play for you all. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker, who don't necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prayer Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. This is breakthrough news that you're about to hear or listen.
Breakthrough.
Welcome to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman. Now to our first story.
Mass arrests of immigrants in the United States, massive starvation imposed on the people of Gaza, the Trump administration is on a rampage. I'm Leanne Sima Fullahan, here with Brian Becker, and this is In the News.
Leanne, you are right. The Trump administration is on a rampage at home and abroad. We have a lot to talk about today. The escalating war against immigrant families, and there is an escalating fight back that's going with it. It's happening all around the country. We've been talking about it in recent shows. We interviewed organizers from Ventura County. What they're doing is, in a way, kind of a model for how resistance can build. But a growing cross-section of people and organizations are coming together to sort of stop the all-out assault on basic human rights that we're witnessing against immigrant families. And we have to talk about Gaza. I had told someone before the show, I can't even really watch social media or look at it because it's too horrible. I mean, looking at video clip after video clip of Palestinian civilians being gunned down, young kids being shot by drones, individuals and families standing together waiting for food when they're desperately hungry and then being slaughtered at aid stations, so-called aid stations, which are just becoming killing fields. I couldn't watch the social media, but we have to talk about it because the Trump administration has now just broken off so-called ceasefire talks. Steve Witkoff, Trump's envoy, has said that Hamas is responsible for the ending of the talks. I mean, complete nonsense. But we want to get to what is the real goal of the Trump administration by refusing to intervene to end the genocide, in fact, facilitating the genocide. Anyway, a lot to talk about.
The numbers are pretty dramatic, Brian. Comparing June 2025 to June 2024, the average daily arrests made by ICE or the Department of Homeland Security of undocumented immigrants or immigrants is up 268%. Now, to break that down, because in the beginning of the Trump administration, if you remember, people were saying, well, actually, there's less arrests than there were under Biden. Maybe this is all talk. Maybe it's not real. But we're watching the numbers go up and up every month. The biggest spike happened in June. So in early June, daily arrests went up dramatically. They were at something around 250 per day since July 2024. And that stayed pretty consistent until early January. And then in around February, they went up to about, seems somewhere between 500, 600. And then in early June, Brian, it went up to almost 1,000 and above 1,000. June 4, there were 2,000 arrests. And the other thing, I'm looking at an article here from The Guardian that's analyzing the data from a variety of different data research sites, but most specifically from the Deportation Data Project that used the Freedom of Information Act to get some of this data. It wasn't publicly available. The interesting thing is that the only way that they were able to reach up to 1,000, 2,000 arrests per day was by dramatically increasing the number of arrests of individuals that have no criminal record. And for the first time in U.S. history, the number of immigrants without a criminal record who have been arrested has overtaken the number of immigrants who are arrested with a criminal record. Now, just to be clear, nobody here is saying that a criminal record is a reason to be arrested by ICE. But what this shows is that Trump's claim that he's arresting the criminal immigrants is actually not only untrue because we know it's untrue, it's untrue in the numbers. Most of the arrests are happening at workplaces now, Home Depots. They're really just trying to fill the quota. And just one more number here. Where do they want to go? This is still actually far below where they want to go. Besides these spikes in June, still the daily average is somewhere around 711 daily arrests. Tom Homan wants to go, he announced this early in July, he wants to go up to 7,000 daily arrests. That's his goal. The big, beautiful bill just gave $45 billion to ICE to make that possible.
So I'm looking at the same Guardian article. Daily arrests spiked further after a heated meeting on May 21st when Stephen Miller, you know, I'm looking at some of the videos of him as a teenager. The guy has been a fascist for a long time. Stephen Miller, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, and Kristi Noem, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary, Miller ordered ICE officials to aim for 3,000 arrests a day or 1 million a year. So 365 days a year times 3,000, that would be 1 million a year. Now, you can only reach that number really by arresting people en masse, whether they have, quote, a criminal record or not. And also, what's so clear is DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, so-called Elon Musk's baby in the beginning, they were going in and basically getting all of the data from these different government agencies so that they could just locate immigrants at work, immigrants at home. In other words, even immigrants who had been, you know, following all the rules and are consequently registered with the government, they did that because they wanted to play by the rules. And as a consequence, the government has their data. Those are the people who are being targeted.
I mean, now it's people are asking for assistance. A lot of organizers are basically organizing teams of citizens to accompany immigrants to their immigration appointments, because that's where a lot of people are getting picked up. They're actually in the process. They're in the pipeline, and they go up to their routine appointment and they are being arrested and then put in the track for deportation.
On June 4th, ICE arrested nearly 2,000 people in that single day. That's the highest number, Leanne, of people arrested in a single day, according to nearly 10 years of arrest records that the Guardian newspaper was looking at. And again, this is in order, there's no national security. And again, a lot of the earlier arrests of people or the deportations were taking place at the border when people were coming through the border. And ICE officials or border and customs and border patrol were saying, like, you're not eligible to come in. But there's nobody coming into the border right now. The border is basically closed. Nobody's trying to come in. So these arrests, Leanne, are taking place not at the border, but everywhere but the border.
Just for numbers on, just to see how much it's gone down, the immigration at the border. In February, for the entire month of February, 2025, there was less than 9,000 migrants that were processed at the U.S.-Mexico border, the entire border. During the Biden administration, there were more than 10,000 people in a day who were going through the border. So just to give a sense of how dramatically decreased the amount of migration there is at the U.S.-Mexico border right now.
And of course, the Trump administration and the Trump team will say, well, this shows that our policy of mass deportations is working because now the flow of people trying to come to the United States is diminished. I mean, people are not trying to do it. So, yes, I mean, if you impose sort of fascist-like tactics and are arresting farm workers and separating moms from their kids, yeah, that's going to be a deterrent for immigrants who are seeking asylum or trying to come to the United States. That's going to, you know, have an impact on them. But it's going to have a profound impact on everything that people in the United States consider to be like elementary to democratic rights. I mean, people had a right to asylum. They had at least a right to an asylum hearing. They had a right to for asylum eligibility. Also, the United States always prided itself on being a country of immigrants. You know, we quote the Statue of Liberty frequently, give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The U.S. prided itself on the fact that it was a melting pot of immigrants. Again, the economic consequences, they're only starting to become evident, but it's very obvious, Leanne. The U.S. labor force is an aging labor force. I mean, the citizen labor force. The U.S. economy is dependent on immigrant labor. This is going to hurt big sections of American capitalism. But actually, Trump doesn't care. And people would say, well, isn't the Trump administration and the U.S. capitalist government supposed to represent the interests of the capitalists? And if this is actually hurting business, doesn't it then sort of cut against that notion that the U.S. government is, in fact, representing business interests? Well, the answer is yes and no. I mean, it's not a straight line. There's not, we don't have a deterministic attitude towards this correlation between the U.S. government and the class interests it represents and the specific everyday interests of commercial business enterprises. Chairman Mao said politics is in command in the contemporary era, meaning the politics of the capitalist state, or in this case, the faction of the capitalist ruling class that's running the capitalist government at the moment, that would be the Trump administration, they're pursuing an ideological right-wing agenda on many, many fronts. Will it harm the capitalist class in general? Well, you can make the argument that yes, it will. The old existing system where you had 14 million undocumented workers who could be super exploited because they didn't have legal rights, weren't part of unions for the most part, they could constitute a low-wage workforce that was very available and very usable and very profitable for the capitalists. So one section of the capitalist class will think, like, this is hurting my business. I mean, you look at the factories, especially the ones in the South that are dependent on immigrant labor for all kinds of meat processing, or people working in the fields, people working in construction, people working in hospitality, in hotels and restaurants. That section of the capitalist class will at least be momentarily harmed. But Trump doesn't care because he's not actually trying to manage the interests of the entire capitalist establishment, which, you know, is the normal role of a capitalist government. They're trying to, the Trump administration and the Project 2025 people who he really represents, they're driving this hard right extremist agenda because they want to shake up the United States. They want to reshape American governance, get rid of a lot of what we have considered to be normal in the last 50, 60, 70 years, do away with the reforms from the civil rights movement, immigration reform, environmental reform, labor reform. That's their agenda. And immigrant families are paying a terrible, awful price. And Leanne, there's also resistance. You know, there was the July 1st sick out. There's the tremendous opposition that we saw from the folks in Ventura County. Many, many organizations are now coming together to form a united front to defend immigrant families. And that's the other part of the story. It's happening. People are starting to fight back. People are fighting back.
That's right, Brian. I mean, that's always the other side of it. There is no oppression without resistance. And the point is here is that the more that Trump attacks our immigrant neighbors, attacks immigrant families, and then the community then comes out in defense. I mean, there's so many stories, Brian, that we've heard of even places in conservative areas of the country where a beloved waiter is then arrested and put into a detention center. And then all these people who may have had right-wing ideas are horrified that someone who was part of their life that they talk to every single day at the local diner or coffee shop is being attacked. Then they start to see the Trump administration's policies and agenda for what it is. So I think this is a really important way we have to emphasize always that the fact is that Trump is making this huge attack. The numbers are going up. But so is the rejection of Trump's policies is going up, and that's showing through organization and through people taking action.
No, I agree with you, Leanne. I want to turn to Gaza real quick. I mean, as I mentioned in the beginning, I can't really watch it anymore on social media, and I think that's true for millions of people. It's too horrifying. The Israeli regime, using fascistic tactics, mass starvation, genocide, is unrestrained at the moment. The Trump administration, which might have been a restraint because, of course, Israel is a dependency on the United States, they've just canceled the so-called ceasefire talks. Again, let's talk about Gaza, what's actually happening and what's likely to happen. Again, there are some voices in Europe, in the ruling class circles in Europe, like Macron in France, who says he wants to recognize a Palestinian state, to which the Trump administration is now like dissing Macron and says, no, under no circumstances, we don't care about any of that. Anyway, Israel unrestrained. We get to see what the Zionist regime really looks like.
I mean, what we're watching right now, what we're witnessing is we're witnessing what actually settler colonialism looks like in real time. I mean, for decades, the Palestine Solidarity Movement was explaining that actually the Israeli state is a project of colonial occupation of the Palestinian land. It was explaining how apartheid was a function of the settler colonial project, you know, helping us understand other historical examples and contemporary examples of colonialism and across the world. But what we're witnessing right now is we're actually seeing the Israelis, with full U.S. support, attempt to not only ethnically cleanse Gaza from the Palestinian population, but then also occupy it. They are using starvation and famine as a weapon right now. They are making life completely unlivable. And we can talk about how unlivable it is. But like you said, it's actually kind of, it's hard to characterize because it's so brutal. It's so inhumane. It's just actually manufactured mass killing and death. And they're making life so unlivable that then they can claim that people are voluntarily leaving Gaza. That's the plan. That's actually the actual plan that has been leaked to the media of the Israeli government right now. They want to force everybody into the southernmost area of Gaza, create what they're calling a humanitarian city, which will be completely surveilled. It's basically a concentration camp. Even the Israeli media is calling it a concentration camp. And then they will have a pathway to voluntarily leave. There is no voluntary here because the choice is starvation, imprisonment in open air, or leaving. Now, of course, the Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance are still insisting that there is a ceasefire agreement that allows in the entrance of humanitarian aid that stipulates some withdrawal of the Israeli military. And that was what was being negotiated up until yesterday. And in fact, Hamas was being very flexible. They were saying that they weren't demanding that Israel has to leave the entirety of the Gaza Strip. They were saying just move back from the densely populated areas and some of the main thoroughfare roads so people can move. And they actually put an 800-meter perimeter that in which they would accept Israeli occupation forces. Hamas has been doing anything they possibly can to get Israel to sign some form of even a temporary agreement so that aid could come in. Because the starvation is so bad, Brian. One third of the population doesn't eat for multiple days in a row. And then when they do eat, it's what? One piece of bread, maybe. There's children who are drinking water and salt in order to survive. People have sometimes don't have water.
Breakthrough.
We want to move on to another very important story, and that is, well, it's a number of kind of interlocking stories there. Political corruption, cryptocurrency, and the intersection, perhaps, of those two things. And we are super, super honored to be joined here on the show by Jacob Silverman, who's been writing a lot of great pieces about crypto and political corruption, and also is the author of the forthcoming book, Gilded Rage, Elon Musk, and the Radicalization of Silicon Valley. I'm definitely going to be reading that. Jacob, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, really great to have you. And there's so much to dig into here on a number of different fronts. And I think where I want to start and the whole sort of piece about cryptocurrency and a lot of what's happening with the deregulation around it is, I think the way a lot of people look at like quote unquote regulation is that, you know, it's good to regulate things that are bad and, you know, things that are fine, we should deregulate them. But I think crypto is in this sort of space where a lot of people are like, oh, well, it's this great new store of value. It's like buying gold or something like that. Or whatever it may be. So I wanted to kind of start there. Like, is cryptocurrency and the sort of rise of cryptocurrency something people should actually be concerned about in terms of our need to look at it more deeply and regulate it?
Yeah, I would say that's something we've learned from experience over the last decade or more. I mean, I wrote about a previous crypto crash in 2022 when FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried's company fell apart and there were other multi-billion dollar frauds. And a lot of regular people lost money because they were sort of taught to believe in the speculative market through a lot of celebrity ads and powerful people saying that crypto was the future. And ultimately, when the bottom fell out of this market because a lot of it was fraudulent, it hurt regular consumers. And I thought we'd have a longer time before reinflating that bubble and a lot of it coming back again. But of course, it happened very quickly, as things tend to in crypto. The bubble reinflated. You had the cryptocurrency industry completely aligning with the Republican Party and putting forth more than $200 million to reelect Donald Trump in 2024. So, you know, this is not just kind of some speculative gambling market. I would actually argue that crypto in many ways is more of a predatory financial scheme, like payday loans. I mean, that's how I think we have to think of it. And now it's underwriting probably the biggest act of financial corruption in presidential history in the case of Trump's many crypto interests. So to me, it's a bigger deal than ever in that its malign effects, its potential for harm is greater than ever. At the same time, I think a lot of everyday people, fortunately, aren't as interested in crypto anymore. It's actually powerful actors in business and government, I think, who are pushing crypto on the rest of us now.
Well, that's a great point, because it does lead us, as you said, to President Donald Trump. I mean, he seems to be right at the center of certainly the deregulatory policies, but also making quite a bit of money. I mean, I almost don't even know how to talk about it, because honestly, having read some of your pieces, I thought I knew, and it's actually deeper than I thought it was. I mean, Trump stands to make a huge amount of money from the policies he's putting in place, and it seems like he's pretty openly, you know, opening the door and saying, hey, if you want an intro into my office, you know, this is the way.
Yeah, Trump has several different vehicles, basically, for earning money through crypto. World Liberty Financial, which was co-founded by Trump's sons, Steve Witkoff's sons. Trump had a title there, is probably the most important. That's the one that issues this World Liberty Financial token, also this USD1 stablecoin. Then you have the meme coins, which is through another venture with another friend of Trump's. But the basic point is that he has his hand in many pots. And anyone who wants to enrich Trump, whether he asks for it or not, can just buy some of these tokens or send crypto to one of his crypto company's wallets. And I imagine this is happening, and we know this is happening already with people making eight-figure, nine-figure deals with Trump. But I imagine this is happening on an even greater stage. If you are a foreign leader pretty much anywhere in the world, it is in your direct interest to put some money in Trump's pocket. I mean, this isn't even a moral issue that we're talking about here. From a kind of realpolitik perspective, this is also the language that Trump speaks and is familiar with. So there's obviously no mechanisms really for enforcement anymore, anyone around to enforce the law, or we're way past worrying about the emoluments clause and people and foreign countries renting rooms at Trump Hotel. The potential here is huge, like billions and billions of dollars in illicit funds.
And by sort of maybe loosening the reins is even downplaying it around the cryptocurrency industry. I mean, it creates so many ripple effects on multiple different fronts. I mean, he's also dismantling the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which people could report some of these companies to. But it feels like, you know, by essentially eliminating the regulations, anyone involved in crypto in any way, shape, or form exposed to it is at a much greater risk. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the sort of scale of the deregulatory efforts that they're putting forward here.
Sure. So from day one, Trump has been basically eliminating the rule of law, especially as it relates to financial crimes, high-level corporate crimes. He famously pardoned all the January 6th rioters, but he also pardoned a lot of financial criminals and people who admitted to and confessed to huge acts of fraud. And a number of them were in crypto or in kind of finance or crypto-adjacent industries. So from the beginning, I would argue there was sort of a message put out that these kinds of crimes weren't going to be enforced anymore. And then you had the SEC drop some major cases, including after some people put a lot of money into Trump's crypto companies. The DOJ, which enforces the criminal side of things, decide to stop investigating or stop prosecuting some important crypto-related cases. So everywhere you look, the mechanisms of enforcement, whether civil or regulatory or criminal, were being dismantled very consciously, I think, and very much in line with the crypto industry's goals. Perhaps there are some knock-on effects for Wall Street, but this is something that really came from the crypto industry and the people around Trump, the venture capitalists and other people involved in the crypto industry, including his sons. And so I would argue that this was a very conscious effort, and it was also one that would, from the beginning, clearly benefit Trump, who was knee-deep in the crypto industry before he even took office.
And I know, you know, Elon Musk, of course, is a big promoter of meme coins. And I mean, what's the maybe relationship here between sort of the crypto industry, you know, the sort of and the sort of broader drift we see in Silicon Valley? And I know you got the upcoming book, Gilded Rage, Elon Musk and the Radicalization of Silicon Valley. Like this what we've seen with this sort of right wing tech move that is now influencing our country in such significant ways.
Well, I think crypto has always been broadly right-wing coded in one way or another, but it was more of a libertarian cypherpunk, like against the state sort of thing, like leave me alone to live my life with my encrypted digital currency. There's been a shift in recent years, and I think I saw it especially at the annual big Bitcoin conference this year in Vegas, where J.D. Vance gave a speech. There are a number of senators and members of Congress, all of them Republican, who appeared, and other appointed officials like David Sacks and Beau Hines. And it was really like this convergence of MAGA and crypto. And what the Republican Party has been able to do by very explicitly aligning itself with crypto has been sort of to take that traditional Republican fake populist anti-government sentiment and make crypto part of that. Somehow buying Bitcoin or even buying Trump coin is like putting up a middle finger to the government. I wouldn't claim that this is a coherent philosophy necessarily or make a lot of sense, but you know that's where they've channeled, I think, a lot of that instinct. And also by providing all these opportunities for their fans to buy crypto, you know, whereas a few years ago they might have been selling them timeshares or MLMs or supplements, now they're encouraging them to get into crypto or various branded crypto products related to their political campaigns or their goals. So that's where you've seen this real convergence of kind of MAGA culture, crypto as a business, and also crypto putting a tremendous amount of money towards its policy goals. And one thing I think is also worth noting is, you know, when this inevitably goes bust, as it generally does, because there aren't great underlying fundamentals here, it's going to be the regular people who decide to buy in, like those everyday MAGA people who, you know, unfortunately believe in this stuff or have bought a lot of Trump meme coins. And when that crashes or when Trump and his friends cash out on the backs of MAGA speculators, it's going to be a lot of everyday people who suffer as they do in, you know, every kind of MLM or scam like this.
No, it's a great point. And finally, I'll just ask you, I mean, and this is, as you said, like not a hypothetical of the things that have gone bust before. And there's a long record here of financial malfeasance tied to crypto.
That's right. And, you know, we were kind of lucky in 2022 in that when FTX and a bunch of other crypto exchanges went down and you had this great decline in prices. I mean, there were a lot of everyday people hurt, but there wasn't contagion where it spilled over into mainstream finance. One of the other things Trump is doing is he's making it a lot easier for crypto to access mainstream money on Wall Street. Just the other day, he signed an executive order to allow 401ks to more easily invest in crypto. So there are a lot of ways in which, even if you're not interested in crypto, you still might have financial exposure to it through your retirement account, a fund manager, maybe your employer is going to put it on their balance sheet. Like there are a lot of ways in which we're going to have to play by crypto's rules and be exposed to their risk. And I think that's a real problem for a lot of us. And it's one we're going to have to contend with very soon.
Mm-hmm. Jacob Silverman, author of the forthcoming book, Gilded Rage, Elon Musk and the Radicalization of Silicon Valley. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Freedom Side.
Thank you.
Breakthrough.
We're going to take a quick break here on Breakthrough Radio, but we'll be right back. To Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman.
We want to turn back to another critically important issue, and that is Palestine and, of course, the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the ripple effects that it's having all around the world. And we are very, very honored to be joined once again by Leanne Foulahan, who is the education director at the People's Forum and an editor at 1804 Books. Leanne, thank you so much for joining us here on the Freedom Side once again.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Well, I want to start here with some breaking news and what you think of the significance or maybe lack thereof. France has just decided they will recognize the state of Palestine. So that's the first G7 country to officially recognize the state of Palestine. Give me your thoughts on that, Leanne.
Well, I can't say I'm totally surprised by this move because Macron has been hinting at it for quite some time. He's been kind of himself out to be the one who's going to step in and intervene in this situation. He's been talking about the two-state solution. He wants to recognize a path forward for a two-state solution. He wants a Palestinian state. I think it's significant in historically because France, for those who don't know, France was the original sponsor of the Israeli settler colonial project before the United States saw in it a tactical and strategic objective and then turned all their resources towards becoming that main sponsor. It was France until 1967 that really provided the political cover, the funding, and all the other kinds of support that Israel needed to annex Palestinian land and carry out their program of ethnic cleansing. So the fact that France is now saying they recognize a Palestinian state is in some ways historically significant. The question, though, is what does this mean for the absolutely dire life and death situation that's currently playing out in Gaza and in the West Bank? Is France's recognition of a Palestinian state, in theory, meaning that France is going to do anything, put any political pressure, use any of their means, economic, political, any kind of means that they have to change the situation in which Palestinian people are being shot as they wait in line for minimal amounts of food? Over 100 people have starved to death just in the past few weeks. And that's, again, our numbers are always undercounts. I mean, this is a really dire situation. So nominal recognition of the idea of a Palestinian state, like I said, is historically significant. But is it significant for the life or death situation facing millions of Palestinians right now? That, I think, still has yet to be seen. And I don't think anyone's holding their breath for France to put really their money where their mouth is right now. Of course, if that does happen, that's great. But they have not, until now, done anything concrete.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've already started talking about it. I mean, the humanitarian crisis, you know, I mean, it's been ongoing, but it's growing so acute with the use of hunger as a weapon. We had the 100, I think over 100 aid agencies discussing the issue of food. And the thing I also want to talk about here, Leanne, in regards to this, and please just, I think, lay out the scale of what's happening, but you know, the Israelis are saying, well, there's all this food, there's all this aid there, and they're just not giving it out, these aid agencies. So they're just like hypocritically criticizing us, and everything is like basically fine. And it just, obviously it's hard to square that with reality and what you see, but of course, you know, it has a propaganda effect. So, I mean, what is really going on here in terms of the aid that's getting in, how it's being distributed, and how that is relating to the famine-like conditions that people are experiencing?
Well, there's absolutely no verification that there is the 900 and something trucks of aid that Israel claims is there in Gaza. Israel is occupying and has evacuation orders for over 83% of the Gaza territory. That's a very small amount of area where people can actually be. There's sometimes reports of some aid, some trucks being able to get in, but most of the distribution right now, I mean, Israel is blocking the UN and other international relief agencies from distributing any aid or aid from entering in. Let's just remember the scene that we're in. Since March 2nd, Israel has placed a total blockade on all borders of the Gaza territory. You can't go out into the ocean. People are shot for even just being on the coast. There's absolutely no ability for people to move in and out of the borders. Sisi from Egypt said that the border on the Egyptian side is open. He made this clarification just this week. It's on the other side where Israel has closed it. So this is a total blockade, total siege. They are the ones who are in control of what goes in. They are also the ones in control of what gets distributed. Now, there's we've talked about it on the show before. There's an aid mechanism that was cooked up by the United States and Israel called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is the one right now that is supposedly distributing aid. Said what they're doing is they're using it as a death trap. They have meager amounts of aid. Some of it, there's reports that have shown that some of it has in it laced opiate drugs and is otherwise contaminated. But anyway, they do have some amounts of aid, which they say they are distributing, but the scenes from that those distribution sites are horrific. An ex-member of the security for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, it's a horrible acronym because it is certainly not a humanitarian foundation, himself left, a U.S. security employee, someone who's worked in conflict zones where the United States has been involved, who is not someone who is unfamiliar with violence, said this is too violent. Shooting down women, shooting down men, shooting down children who are just waiting for flour. Now, for the everyday Palestinian, for all Palestinians in Gaza, the question is, do I risk my life to go get a bag of flour, or do me and the dozens of people in my family go hungry? This is the question that is facing Palestinians every day. There's videos that you can see of someone returning home with a bag of flour and everyone cheering because the question of whether or not they would survive their trip to get flour is a real question, and it's very, very likely that you would not survive. So aid in this context has been turned into a death trap. It has been turned into a weapon of war. Now, the Palestinian demands are that there is an unfettered entry of aid. And even now, just a few bags of flour is nothing in the conditions of mass starvation that Gaza is facing. It's hard to speak about and to quantify because people don't have access to clean water. People don't have access to medicine. The doctors in the hospitals are operating on people without having eaten themselves. There's babies that are dying from malnutrition. There are adults who are dying from malnutrition. The conditions of starvation are here. And it's a man-made condition. It's an Israeli-made condition, Eugene. And, you know, the Western media, the Wall Street Journal, I'm trying to look and see if there's any, you know, top line headline news about this massacre of people through mass starvation that is happening here in 2025 in front of the world's eyes. And the first headline I could find on the Wall Street Journal was dozens of Palestinians seeking aid killed in northern Gaza as they came under fire while waiting for aid to arrive from Israel. Mm. It's an attempt here, and it's a very well-coordinated attempt to mask the fact that Israel and the United States are in cahoots and they're actually using starvation as a weapon. Just a few hours ago, Witkoff announced that they will be withdrawing the U.S. and Israeli negotiators from the ceasefire negotiating table. The Israelis have returned to Tel Aviv. Basically, the talks have stopped. And why? Because Hamas submitted their proposal, their response to the ceasefire proposal that was on the table. They said that they wanted amendments that would include more access for UN aid agencies to distribute aid, and that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation would no longer be a distributor of aid, which is obviously would make sense considering that people are being shot and killed when they're going to receive aid from the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and also that the Israeli military would withdraw from some of the more densely populated zones. This, the Witkoff and the Israelis claimed, shows that Hamas is not serious about a ceasefire, and they have stopped the negotiations. They also then claimed that Hamas is using famine as a negotiating tool, and therefore the talks are illegitimate. Well, Eugene, it's like we're in the Twilight Zone because the United States and Israel are using famine to coerce Palestinians into accepting a new reality of U.S.-Israeli occupation of Gaza. They have plans to push the 2 million people in Gaza to the southernmost area of Gaza, where they would then have the option to voluntarily leave. There's nothing voluntary about any of this situation. When people are starving, when people are constantly being killed, when people are basically being offered the choice between death, a concentration camp, these are not real choices. This is not, there's no voluntary situation here. There's nothing humanitarian about it. The world needs to see this, needs to be outraged. We need to break the silence, but we need to do it now.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's a very good point. And of course, we've seen here in the United States over the past several days, thousands of people take to the streets all around the country demanding stop starving Gaza. And those efforts are continuing and ongoing here in the United States and around the world. And you know, I guess I want to ask you about the significance of that in some ways, because of course, I think all of us who see this just unbelievable moral catastrophe would like to see entities, governments act, you know, 100 days ago, 9 months ago, and not be doing it. But it does seem that for people to continue to advocate is important because we, you know, again, I'm just, obviously they should be doing more. Obviously they should have done it sooner. But now you have Starmer saying he's going to be meeting with Germany and others around the Gaza situation. You had David Lammy, you know, speaking out in the House of Commons, and then an MP saying you actually are complicit in war crimes yourself, which is certainly true. But the point being, it's obviously affecting them. And people who have no desire to do anything other than support the genocide, which they've been doing for 9 months, are now starting to feel like they are under the gun, and that the political consequences and the political crisis is such that it could really cause problems for them. And that seems important for people who are feeling discouraged, and understandably so, that so many people have been fighting so hard, and there's still so much intransigence from so many of these governments around actually doing anything to stop the genocide.
Yeah, it's a totally understandable feeling to have. I mean, it's hard for anyone to talk about the conditions in Gaza. I was just actually talking to others earlier before getting on the show. How can we talk about the starvation there? How can we talk about the genocide? It seems it's unspeakable. The crimes against the Palestinian people are unspeakable. And people have been out in the streets fighting, struggling, raising their voices constantly since this genocide began, and from even before. I do think that it's important to make a distinction here. The fact that the genocide is intensifying is not a reflection on the failure of the movement. It is a reflection on the illegitimacy of the government to represent the views and the demands of its own people. And I don't just even mean the United States government, because people are rising up around the world. Now, there are people who have been having mass protests in France. I'm sure that contributed to Macron's calculation about whether or not he wants to recognize the right of the Palestinian people to have a state. But if he didn't feel that pressure, would he really have done that? I don't think so. The point here is not that that there's nothing that we can do. The point is that the government itself, the United States government, does not represent the interests of its own population, let alone the people of the world. If that was the case, then it would have been a year and a half ago that Biden, after over 500,000 people showed up at the White House doorstep on November 4, 2023, completely unprecedented, he would have then, as the elected representative of the United States population, he should have picked up the phone, called the Pentagon, and ended the genocide, which he could do. Trump can also do the same thing. With one phone call, the United States can pull its support for Israel, and that would end things immediately. Israel cannot do this without the United States. But my point is, I'm repeating myself often because I think this is really important. The point is that government itself is not acting as a representative of the population, not on Palestine and not on a whole wide variety of issues, if not all issues. And I think that's what we have to take away from this. And that means that it helps absolutely no one to stay home. We have to continue advocating, continue standing up, continue raising our voices, because even if the government is not acting in our interest, is not going to respond to our pleas, that does not mean that what we're doing doesn't have an impact. We are creating pressure, we are putting public pressure, we are sending a message to Gaza. We are also making sure that this chapter in history does not go down as something that was okay. We have to make sure that the precedent here is not set. And we also have to put pressure, because we need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make it the calculation of those in power. They have to consider the consequences in public opinion, in their own support. They have to consider the consequences that people are not going to take this silently. They're not going to accept this reality. We have to all participate in this. I hope everyone can participate in some way, whether it's by making a phone call to your representative or coming to the protest, or talking to some of your coworkers about what's going on. The media is not telling us the story, trying to relieve some of that pressure for those in power. We are the ones telling the story. We are the ones who must be the conscience of the people of the world. And I think that we're up for the task.
Well, Leanne, as always, we appreciate it. You are the education director at the People's Forum and an editor at 1804 Books. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Freedom Side.
Thank you so much for having me. See you all in the streets. Breakthrough.
Well, we are going to go ahead and turn to another major geopolitical hotspot, and that is Ukraine, where there is many things happening, some of which are making the news, some of which are not, and we are very...
I'm going to have to end that there as we're getting a little bit at the end of the hour. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker, don't necessarily represent those of WFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. So the first song I played earlier was the Beach Boys from their greatest hits on pop since it's summer. And I am going to play another Beach Boys song. this is Don't Worry Baby, from the Beach Boys, greatest hits. And remembrance of Brian Wilson, who unfortunately passed away last month. So this is the Beach Boys. Views and opinions expressed in error are solely as a speaker and not necessarily represent those of WFT Champaign, Prairie Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WFT Associates. This is, please keep listening to us here on WFT 90.1 FM Radio.